My name is Luke Kay, and I am a member of a home group called New Beginnings. We meet every Thursday night in Chattanooga at 8 p.m. at the intersection of East Brainerd Road and Graysville Road. If you're ever down that way, come on by. I'd like to have another meal. let me jump right into this. I'd like to say before I get started is I'm going to share with you my stories. This is what I think happened. And I have found that the longer I have been in Al-Anon, the more my stories change. The stories of the past that I used to believe so strongly had one set of meanings have changed. And now the same stories seem to mean something very different to me than what they did in the past. So I will share with you my version of where I'm at in my life and as I have continued to change. Some of my stories will be about, will include my wife, and she's with us here today. And my version is better than her version. So you'll get to hear my version. And she can later try to persuade you to a different flavor, but trust me, mine has better fighter and better flack in the stories. So, I came from a family where my mother came from a family. Let me start off by saying this: I've never seen my dad, nor have I ever seen my mother drink. Just wasn't part of my experience. And when I got into Al-Anon, one of the things everyone talked about was the alcoholics in their lives. And I kept thinking, I don't have very many alcoholics in my life. I married one, but I don't have anybody else. And I got to thinking about it one day, and I thought, well, I don't have any alcoholics in my life if you don't count my two older brothers and my older sister and my three uncles and my cousins. And I'm not sure why I was blind to the fact that alcohol had always been there, but somehow I had this great illusion that it was not part of our family. And yet I had these behaviors that, as I have been in Al-Anon, I can see are something that get passed on. We almost get taught. We're almost hypnotized into having beliefs that really are based on just someone having modeled behavior for me. So let me jump into this. My dad came from a Midwest background. He lived in a town that was three blocks wide and six blocks long. And for his family, life was life. Life was tough. You did what you needed to do. They remember the Dust Bowl. They remember the Depression. They lived through all that. They remember all the things that a family in the Midwest would go through as they grew up. When time came for him to leave home, he told his dad he was going to be leaving. The next day or two, he just disappeared. He had jumped on a freight train and he was gone because that's just what you did. That's the way life worked. And my mother came from a family that was in the Deep South. And she came from a very different culture in which the family was everything. It was very much a part of everything. And it didn't matter what your family did, you stuck together. And if something happened in the family, you don't talk about it. You just, that's in the family. And if someone in the family is a certain way, you don't criticize it. That's just the way they are, but they're family. And I never thought anything about that. I thought that was just the way life was. I was sure your family was exactly that way. And because you never told me about your stuff, I certainly knew to keep whatever we had going on inside the family. And so my dad was a military man. My mom and dad had married, and I was part of a second marriage. And we moved a lot. And one of the things I never noticed until I became older was that I always knew when I landed somewhere I was going to start every relationship out with a goodbye. That was military life. You're going to be there a couple of years. I'm not part of this. We're just associates. I never thought of it that way, but that's exactly the model that I had picked up just from being in this family. And we lived in We lived in Omaha, Nebraska. We lived in different parts of Colorado. We lived in Alaska. We lived in Arizona. We lived in Minnesota. We lived in Texas. If you get the idea, we just moved around to different places. One of the other things I can say is that I don't have very many memories of my mother's side of the family, and only a few of my dad's side when I met their parents. But what I do remember, never thought about it at the time when I first joined Al-Anon, but I do remember my earliest memory of my granddad, my mother's dad, was I was sitting on one of his knees, and my younger brother was sitting on the other knee, and as we sat on the knee, he would pop a can of beer, and he'd take a sip. Then I'd get a sip. Then Grandpa'd get a sip, and my brother would get a sip. Well, Grandpa was getting two sips for one. My earliest memory. Never thought a thing about it. I did know that something in the family was going on, but we don't talk about that. Sometimes even in the family, in which when he would drink, something would happen where they had to kind of protect Grandma from Grandpa. He would get mean or something, and they would just have to keep him at bay. But we were little kids. We didn't get to see any of that. But you know how you pick up on things, and you absorb them, and they become part of the psyche, and you end up using that in life. But I thought it was a normal life. I will say, my mother was one of those people that would try to force me to do things. And I was kind of a stubborn kid, and I'm sure my mother was the problem. But it doesn't change the fact I think I might have been a real handful. In fact, I think that I'm a broken thinker. I learned ways of thinking that just don't work the way the real world works, but I sure hung on to those ways of thinking. One of my earliest memories was I remember we lived on a farm, and I was up in the top of a barn where they have a big storage area for hay. You know what I'm talking about? They got big doors that swing open to load and get the hay out. And I was up there with one of the little girls on the farm, and I had my chance to impress her. So I grabbed a piece of twine that was hanging from a rafter and decided I'd just kind of swing out the door like Tarzan and come swinging right back in. Half of that plan worked. As the twine broke and I fell, little details about reality began to crawl in. Like there was a pile of bare steel tire rims underneath that I landed in. And wherever the edge of the rims were, different bends and bones went to shaping differently. And I looked down and I thought, I'm scared. So just imagine having a kid like that. Why did it always happen to me? I don't know. One time I was out, do you know what cockleburrs are? I was out in a field of cockleburrs. And the kids in front of me were moving through the cockleburrs, and I was right behind them, and there were some kids behind me. And I turned around and looked back, and one of the kids said, "Hey." And I turned around, and they let go of a branch of cockleburrs, and it just caught me right in the face. And so I would blink, and my eyelids would stay shut. So they took me into a doctor, and he pulls them out one at a time. I thought, things like that happen. My mother was probably pulling her hair out by then. My point I'd like to make about that is that early on, my mother and I had conflict, and we never really got over that. It became worse as time came on, and I just held that against her. I was very angry at my mother most of my life. After we had moved to from where I was born in Omaha, and after we had gone to Alaska, we came back to a place called Minnesota, to a city in Minnesota, and that's where the farm was. And one of the things that I remember thinking about while I was there was that I just never belonged. I just always noticed that. And that stayed with me as we moved from time to place to place. We then went to Arizona. We were there for a couple of years, and then we went to Belmead, Texas. Now, the first phase of my life was just being a kid, getting along, surviving, and absorbing all the stuff I could. But when we got to Waco, things began to change, Waco, Texas. While I was in Waco, Texas, I had reached the point where I was about 14 years old, and I discovered a girl. This cropped up the other evening. That was in 1963. You were having your first meeting, and I was falling in love. That's just the way it was. And I thought she was just amazing. She was 2 years older than me, and I was just, I was enthralled, and she was the preacher's daughter. And the only way I could be around her was to go to church with her. So I started going to this little bitty tiny church. And after I'd been in that church for a while, I noticed I was less interested in her, and I got much more interested in that church. And so I just dropped her, and I started getting real involved because these people were very different to anything I had ever run across. Now, I will tell you that over the years, I came to believe in, that this was kind of like a cult. They were right, and the rest of the world is wrong. I don't know if you've ever met anyone like that, but they not only were they right, everybody else that weren't exactly like them was wrong. You had to be that in that group. Well, I liked that because I was belonging, and I was in the right group, and I had a special truth and secret, and I was really excited about it. So I signed up for it, and I joined in. And these people introduced me to my understanding of a higher power, God. Now, by the way, when I came in last night and I looked around, I thought, oh, I haven't been in a pulpit in years. This is going to be kind of unique. It has a platform. That is a pulpit. There's an organ and a piano. How will this feel? Because it turns out that I decided I wanted to be a minister. Before I ever went to that church, there was an experience that I had that I want to relay. I was standing in the backyard of our house in Waco, and at the age of about 12, standing underneath a chinaberry tree, I just suddenly knew I was going to be a minister. I didn't even know what that was, and that I would never have children. That was the two things I knew. It was settled in my mind. There was no ambiguity on this. To this day, that is settled in my mind. There's no ambiguity in that. That was something that was going to happen. And then a few years later, I get involved with this church, and I decide that this is what I want. And they told me what God was all about and what truth was, and this is the only truth. And my concept of a higher power became very complicated. You have to do it exactly this way. You have to do this, you have to do that, and here's what God will do, and if that doesn't happen. I was taught that if I prayed certain prayers, I would get answers to those prayers, and if we were really good, we could put God in a corner where he had no choice but say yes. That's what they taught me. I would pray my prayers and I didn't get answers. Now, that bothered me because I was doing pretty good on the rest of the stuff. And as this went along, I was always concerned about why I was not as comfortable as I wanted to be, but I sure wanted to be a part of that. I went on to a seminary. I graduated from a seminary out of Texas, and I went back to a place called Spartanburg, South Carolina, and I pastored a church for 8 years. Now, what's important to know is that I got married right after I took the church. I got married to someone. I didn't know who to get married to, so I called up someone I knew. She didn't have any really good prospects, so she said yes. So she left Texas and came to South Carolina, and we pastored a church. Now, I was a terrible husband. I didn't marry her because I loved her. I didn't marry her because of any reason except I needed a wife, I was pastoring a church, and I thought maybe she could sing. That's it. And she was a really good person, but I was a terrible husband. And I don't even know how terrible I was, because in the faith that we were in, the men were right and the women were supposed to be quiet. If I said it, that was the end of that conversation, and she bought into that. I was a monster. I asked my dad one time. He said, "Yeah." He said, "Lou, you were a monster." I said, "How? I mean, how bad was I?" He said, "I'll give you one example. One day, your wife worked really hard to put some curtains up in the house because you were poor and you didn't have much. And when you came home, you didn't like them, so you just pulled them off the windows." It's not a very noble story, but it's a true story. It's what I thought, it's what I believed, and I was so confused, and I had so many things I believed about life, and I was just wrong. I want you to understand that as a guy like me, that gets it wrong, I hang on to it and I use it anyway. And I thought I was doing this because I had the right to do it. So I think I had a lot of things in my head that were really confused from early childhood right on through my teenage years. Now, I was also, as I told you, as a pastor, but I wasn't necessarily the sanest pastor either. We had a church that wasn't any bigger than this, and instead of chairs, we had pews. And they were shiny wood pews, no padding on them. And the back kind of curved a little bit, and the seat curved like this so you could slide down in and be nice. And it was Easter Sunday, and I thought, well, we need to just polish those pews up. So I went out and bought a bunch of cans of what they call Pledge. And I buffed those pews really, really well. They were shiny, slick too. So Easter morning, I'm up and I'm speaking, and as I'm looking, I look at the congregation and their heads are going like this. It looked like little waves of people. And I was so confused by that, but I stayed with it. Came time to end the service, and they got up, and as they were filing out the back, I noticed that the backs of their suits were all shiny. I was horrified. I was their pastor. One time, it was late at night, the phone rang, and the person on the phone said, hey, I have a sister here. She's very sick, and she has multiple sclerosis, can barely move, but she wants to be baptized, and she's not doing well. Could we meet you at the church and baptize her? We said, well, sure, bring her on. It was late at night. So we met at the church. The woman I was married to at the time was about 4'10", weighed about 85, 90 pounds. And we had a baptistry, kind of like this table here behind me, and it was full of water, and I could stand outside the baptistry, and they would go into the water, then I would bend them over under the water, and we had to get you all the way under, and then I'd bring them back up. Well, we hadn't had a baptism in a good while, and I hadn't noticed that the water level had evaporated, and it was kind of low. In fact, it was pretty low. But we were ready to go, so she stood there. She was a large woman, and I grabbed her I said, hold your nose like this, hold your wrist like this, and then when I take you over, I'm going to put you under the water and pull you up. You got that? Yeah. When I went over with her, she pulled me over on top of her. And because there was a bar between me and her, the wall of the baptistry, I jackknifed, and I'm down in the water with her, but my feet are hanging out the other side, and this woman can't do anything but hang on, and I bounced her a couple of times, could not get her to go, and my wife ran up and leaped on the back of my legs. And down we went, and the woman got almost out, and under she went again. And finally, after two or three tries, we got my feet on the floor, and we got her back up. And she said, I said, how are you? She said, I've never felt so close to God. And she was right. She was right. So I'm a broken thinker. Things happen in my life and I don't know how to explain them. Girls in hay malls and people in baptistries. I've got a couple of stories I'll tell you about what happened in my second marriage. So while I was in this faith, I noticed a couple of things. One was I never really felt like my outsides matched my insides. Something in me had never changed no matter what I did. We fasted, we prayed, I did all the stuff they talked about. But I never changed on the inside. And one day I stood in the pulpit and I said, I just need to be real with you. I stand up here and I talk about how I know a way to go to heaven. I know a way for you to be saved. I know all these words that I use. but I don't even know if I'm going to make it. Something in me hasn't changed. And it wasn't very long after that I resigned and I decided, you know, I'm out of here. I'm angry that I couldn't find faith. I'm angry that I was in a faith where all the stuff they talked about I could not achieve. And I just resigned. I left my wife, and I went out and started my life over. And that began 10 years of me just trying to figure out what life is all about, most of which I just lived in debauchery. I just decided I was out of it, I was finished. I used to talk about the fact I would open the Bible, if it said, thou shalt not, I think I'll give it a try. That was just my attitude about it. I just really was bitter toward this religious experience that I didn't have, that I had heard about. So I moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee, had gotten a job there. And by the way, I have amazing things that just happened in my life, and I can't explain them. I was a private pilot for a period of time right after I got out of the ministry. And I was flying along one night. Something had happened when I was taking off from this little dirt strip up in North Carolina, and I saw something flash by the window. I said, well, I don't know what that was. And it turned out it was the belt that drove the alternator that kept the electronics running. Details, I know, but they matter. And so I'm flying along, and I'm trying to land in Charlotte because I'm low on fuel, and as I'm in the pattern, all of a sudden, all my electronics go out, all my position lights go out. It's late at night, and so I just go ahead and peel out of the pattern. I'm flying on up, trying to get some altitude so I can see, and I'm trying to follow the cars on the interstate down below, hoping to get to the airport down in Spartanburg. It turns out that a bunch of cars had just turned off towards Shelby, North Carolina, and I had followed them towards Shelby. And I'm going along, and all of a sudden the prop goes, phew. Well, my instructor said, fly to the darkest place you can find because there won't be lights, poles, and wires. Well, for me, that turned out to be a mountain. I didn't know that black spot was a mountain. So I'm just tooling along, going to get as much glide path as I could, and I topped that mountain with probably 100 feet to spare. And on the other side was a small airport with the lights still running and nobody was there. And I just coasted down, rolled to a stop, got out, pushed that little plane right off the runway, and I called my 4'10", 85-pound wife and said, come get me. I was still in the ministry and married about that time. I'm just lucky to be here. I not just broken arms, it was broken planes. Went to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I was working for a company there, and I met my wife. Now, when I met her, she was already married, and I wasn't. I was just a guy batching it and just living a wild and crazy life. But I met her, and when I first saw her, something about her clicked for me. Now, that's a magic phrase for me. Something about you just fits my brain. But she was married, so I just left alone, but I always noticed her. The company I was with had bought a big piece of another company. I went to California to run a piece of that business, and while I was out there, she had ended up getting a divorce, and I found out that she had separated or divorced her husband, so I came back and I said, how about a date? I'm a broken thinker. It turns out the first time I took her on a date, I borrowed a friend's car. It was a Jeep Cherokee that he had left the windows down on a hot, wet night in Chattanooga, and it was full of mosquitoes. We couldn't wait to get out of that car. It was just a buzz on the inside. And I noticed that something about her just really fit my brain. Now, what I can say is this, that while I was single during that 10 years, I did a lot of dating, and if I went to a party, I could walk in the room and I could somehow wander through that crowd and I would find a drinker. I would pass everybody else by and I would find an alcoholic. They reminded me of my sister, they reminded me of my mother, they reminded me of my brothers, they reminded me of something. And if there were 50 and there was only one alcoholic woman, my nose would be on her shoulder within 5 minutes. Hi, how are you? Well, something about this woman that I had met that I was going to marry, I didn't know it at the time, but I sure was enjoying meeting her, was something I told her. I said, I don't know what it is about you, but you just fit my brain. Well, she would have things happen and I could rescue her. What a great experience. I mean, that made her so much fun. I had on a blue suit, a red cape. I had a big K right here on the front. I could leap small hurdles and look big. But I hadn't noticed that she drank too much. I was totally blind to this thing of alcoholics in my life. One time I flew in from California, and it was really cold, and I come off the plane. I'm in the terminal, and I look over, and here she is standing here like this, jerking around. Well, she's never done that before. I thought this was noticeable because she was dripping on the floor at the same time. She is just soaking wet. And I said, what happened? She said, I was driving over here to pick you up from the flight. I was running a little late, and I ended up, and the car's in a puddle, and it won't start. It's a puddle? Yeah. Well, let's go look at this puddle. So we jumped in the car. We went over and looked at the puddle, and we found the car. You could see the headlights under the water. It was there. And she had just gotten out of the car after it flooded and just walked across the swollen stream to the other side to get to the terminal. And then, that was rather strange. I wonder why she did that. It never dawned on me there might be a problem. I was still in California. I asked her to marry me. She did. She came to California. She had moved out there and was working out there with her company. And we got married. And we thought it was the greatest thing on a weekend to go out and do wine tastings, liquor tastings, go to the bars, sit around the fireplaces, watch the hills of Malibu get caught on fire and burned to the ground. I mean, anything was an excuse to go drink. And I could be a hero if I brought her a bottle of wine. I love making an alcoholic happy. They're so easy. And every alcoholic I ever made happy, I really enjoyed in the early stages of their disease. A blossoming alcoholic is a delight. But you get a real alcoholic that has matured, they're like a cataract. Things aren't as clear as they used to be. And she progressed amazingly well with my help. California, cool morning. I'd jump out of bed with all my sober energy. I'd dash down to the kitchen, I'd pop a bottle of red wine, pour some in a glass, warm it up in the microwave that we bought, and just bring it up and serve it to her in bed. I'm a broken thinker. I don't even realize the rules I operate off of. And one day, I used to buy the most expensive scotch I could buy. I didn't have a problem with it, but it kept disappearing. I said, why don't you drink that less expensive stuff if you're going to drink that much? I didn't know she didn't have a choice. Bottom line, one day it got so bad, she finally decided she needed to check herself into a clinic. She needed help. I could see that she needed help. We got her down there. We put her in, and I helped her a lot in her recovery. I was there to let her know, don't worry about a thing. I'm going to cover for you with the boss. Don't worry about this. Don't worry about money. Don't worry about any of this stuff. And so she went through her treatment. She came out and she stopped drinking. And I'll tell you what, for 5 years, she was sober. She did not drink. Later she told me the most miserable 5 years of her life. She was just white-knuckling her through through her days. But during that time, just right after she came out of treatment, she started going to AA meetings. Now, I wanted to help her, so I made sure I went to the meetings with her. Sense how this is not the healthiest of relationships going on here. And I'd sit right there next to her so she wouldn't leave or anything. And I'm sure she was getting a lot out of that. And I thought maybe if we'd go to the best psychologist or psychiatrist in Beverly Hills, that would accelerate progress here. So we went. And finally, that's how we ended up in AA and Al-Anon, by the way, is the psychiatrist said she needs to go to AA, and the message I got out of that conversation is I need to go to Al-Anon. So I did. And Al-Anon, I was known for a long time as the whiner with the wino. And I would go to meetings and moan and groan about what a tough time I have and how I'm being brave about it. And, you know, how do you fix this? And I just wanted to fix her. But she got better on her own somehow. We were there, and for five years she was sober, and she came home. And I came home to Chattanooga, and we were living there. And we still live there. But one day, she had to serve some kind of a event, because she was in sales, and she had to have all this alcohol she would take to them, and she had some bottles from the last event, and she wasn't sure whether the alcohol had evaporated, and so she needed to make sure that it was still worth serving. And the only way to figure that out was to take a little sip of each one. That didn't work out. She was back on a tear. Well, all of this is being said to say this, is that I was helpful to my wife in every way I knew how, and not one bit of my help made any difference to help her. I was an enabler in every sense of the word, and I thought that was how we showed love, because that's how my mother showed love to her alcoholic brother. That's how my mother showed love to her other alcoholic brother. That's how my mother had learned to show love for her alcoholic relatives. And I thought that's what you did when you loved someone, is you covered for them and you made the pain go away. I was as much a problem as the alcohol. So she decided, you know, she had to work her way. I went to Al-Anon, and I finally, it just got so bad that I didn't know what to do. In fact, I guess I'll say that my alcoholic was someone that I taught the art of brinkmanship to. I was training her as much as she was training me. And it was, metaphorically, it was like being on the Grand Canyon. I'd gone to the Grand Canyon, was up on that high plateau, and you walk up to the Grand Canyon, if you keep going, you just fall off. There's no fence there to stop you. There's no anything. You just go off the edge. And it's almost like we were up on that plateau, and my alcoholic wife would jump up in her and say, I'm going to run toward the edge of the Grand Canyon, and I'd stop her. I'd save her. And then she learned, well, he'll stop me from going over the edge. One day she got by in this metaphor, and she went over the edge a little bit, but she hung on by her fingers, and I was there to pull her back up. Well, if I keep that pattern up, she's going to learn after a while that she can just run full tilt right over the edge, because Lou's going to be there to fix it. And I woke up and I realized I am as much the problem as she is. So I was scared at what I had done, and I sat down and talked to some folks in Al-Anon about it. And I came home and I said, Sue, I need to say this to you, and I need to do this, and I'm not going to do it right. I don't know how to do this right. But there's a concept called detachment. And I'm going to detach from anything that has to do with alcohol in your life. If you drink, you drink. If there's a consequence, you have to fix it. If you have a problem and you can't go to work, you have to fix that. I'm out of it. I don't know how to do that except to just stop. And so I detached with an axe. I did not know how to detach with love. And the reason that's important is because until I got out of her business, she was never in her business. Well, she came to the door of the bedroom one day, and she said, I'm really in bad shape. I can barely walk. Would you check me into a center? I said, sure. So we got her in the car, and we drove. I said, where do you want to go? She said, I don't know. You pick. I said, nope, I'm detaching. I'm not picking anything. She said, okay, don't try this one, don't try that one because I've been there, don't try that one because I've been there, let's go to this one. I said, fine. Took her over and I parked. I said, here we are. She said, I can't walk, can you help me in? I said, nope, I'm detached. She said, well, would you go get a nurse? I said, yeah. I went and got a nurse. The nurse came out, helped her in, and they said, could you help answer these questions? I said, nope, I'm detached. And they finally, and Susan worked her way through it as best she could. Finally, they said, would you sign this? I said, nope, I'm detached. And so she signed herself in. Those nurses looked at me and she said, she ain't yours no more. She's ours. We're going to put her in the car, and all we want you to do is drive her down to Birmingham to this location, and you turn her in and you leave, and we'll call you. And that's exactly what we did. We took her down, got her in, and it was her recovery. She worked through all of that by herself. She worked it through with her company. She worked it through with her parents. She worked it through in her life. I'm not saying I did it right, but I can say to you today, I believe the only contribution I ever made to the recovery of my wife was when I got out of her business. And her recovery is 100% her recovery. When she stood up last night, she stood up because she wanted to stand up. She stood up because it was her 8 years, had nothing to do with me whatsoever. We don't even talk about that alcohol. I think I'm still detached. And that's the way it ought to be. I'm no longer the whiner with the wino. Let's talk about me in recovery for a little bit. When I first got into Al-Anon, I was there to figure out all the things to do to that woman so that I could be happy. One time I was in a meeting, and someone said this, and it still sticks in my mind. They said, "Can you be happy?" See, how did they say that? "Can you still be happy if you can't have what you want?" And I thought about that. Can I be happy if I can't have what I want? And I said, no. I said, you're in trouble. There's a whole lot you can't have. And today, I get that. I needed her to change so I could be happy. I needed my boss to change so I could be happy. I needed my friends to be a certain way so I could be happy. And the bottom line was, the only person I even have a chance at is me. Step one, when they started taking me through the steps, was just great. Step one, I've been through the steps multiple times. And let me say, every time I've done the steps, noise goes out of my life. My head has conversations in it that just go on and on and on and on and on. It's the same conversation with a different person, or a different judge, or a different cop, or a different parent, or a different boss. Every time I've done the steps, noise, conversations peel out of my head, and they diminish and begin to go away. And step one for me came to be this: I am powerless to change the insides of another human being. And if I have to change the inside of someone else for me to be happy, my life will be unmanageable as long as that decision prevails. Today, I can't change the inside of me. I even need the steps, this program, and a higher power to do that. Even in Al-Anon, I'm a broken thinker. I try to force solutions. My mother was that way. I try to make things happen. And sometimes I'm a people pleaser too. You ever seen a manipulator, someone that tries to impress you inappropriately? One day I said to my wife, I tried to force a solution. This bed's got a low spot over here where I sleep in it, and I need a new mattress. Oh, we don't want to buy a mattress right now. I want a mattress. I need a mattress. Oh, we don't need a mattress right now. I need a mattress right now. She said, okay, we'll get a mattress. So, but I don't want this kind of mattress. I want one that's called an East Coast king, a queen size mattress. And this is a king size mattress. So we need to buy a new bedstead. I said, oh, okay. And so that was agreed to, and they said, well, now the end tables don't match the bedstead anymore. We've got to have to have end tables. I said, okay. Well, if we're going to get end tables, we need an entertainment center that can sit right at the foot of the bed so that we can see the TV. Oh, okay. Yeah, we can do it. If we're going to put in a new bed and bed tables, and we might as well put in new carpet, right? I mean, this old carpet's down here. Okay. Well, if we're going to do the carpet, you might as well do the wallpaper, too. We've got to have the wallpaper and the ceiling here with the popcorn. Can you believe that got out of hand? All I thought I wanted was one thing, and I turned into more. You say, well, Lou, that only happens once. No, it does, and it happens over and over. Let me give you an example. I came in one day, I was feeling grandiose, and I said, babe, if it would make you happy and you spent every penny we had in savings, I wouldn't say a word. About 6-8 weeks later, I came home. There was a dining room table in our place that I had never seen. There were Barber Berry chairs stuck around it, which I didn't even know what those were. They didn't look cheap, though. And there was a hunter's board. You know what those are? I'd never had one of those. And we had a brand new blue suede couch. And there's a back bedroom with a bed in it, and another chest of drawers, if you catch my drift again. I have a way of just meddling with life, and then when it gets crazy, I think, how could that happen to me? When I drive back and forth between Knoxville and Chattanooga with my wife, I have learned to shut up, and I don't like being quiet. But I'm riding down that road, sometimes it'll cross my mind at conversation, hey babe, how do you think we're doing as a couple? Now that's, you know, that's broken thinking. You know I should know better than that. How many times have I been burned? And it's not her. I started. But I always, how did that get out of hand? Today I keep myself, I'm learning to keep the focus on me. I don't try to force solutions. And I'm trying to not be a people pleaser either. A couple of things that Al-Anon has done for me that is like a miracle. I was very angry at my mother. In fact, I could tell you I hated my mother. When my mother died, we were estranged. When she died, I showed up for the funeral to kick dirt on her casket. I was very angry at my mother. And I was going to Al-Anon. One night, I began to share with the folks at Al-Anon. I said, here's how it was with my mother. Here's what happened. Here's blah, blah. And one of the people said, oh, my God, didn't you tell us your mother's been dead for like 6 or 7 years? I said, yes. I said, you've made a god out of your mother. She controls you from the grave. She owns you. And that so registered with me, it so shocked me that I just went into almost like a daze, and I walked out the back, out the door at the back of the room. And when I walked out, I said, Mom, I'll let you go if you'll let me go. And it was like a wet overcoat just slid off my shoulders, and I felt a freedom I had never felt in my life before, because I no longer had to hang on to that hate, that anger, that resentment that was eating me up all those years. And it was the first thing that ever happened to me that was so shocking. Another thing that happened to me that was just amazing was I was very angry about God. I'd come out of that cult and that church, and I used to sit in Al-Anon meetings and open AA meetings. I went to a lot of open AA meetings. And I'd say, if there is a God, I'd like to find him, because one of us is going to have to die. I'd say that in a meeting, and they'd say, ooh, that's scary. I wasn't the toughest cookie they had come across. But I did that for several years, and they just put up with it, went on. And then one day, when I finally hit the bottom, I kept having my way, being willful. I was working the steps, and I was crumbling and slowly losing this stuff in my life. I finally realized that I needed a higher power. And that experience that I never had on the inside when I was in that church group, something in me sort of melted. It was like with that thing with my mother. It just went away. And suddenly I said, I'm not negotiating. I'm not asking that you do anything special. Just go through life with me and we'll do it your way. And I just felt something change in me. It just shifted, and I have not been the same since. I get up in the morning. Now, before that happened, let me say this. They used to have what is called 11th step meeting every Sunday night at the East Brainerd Club, and I went to that for a couple of years. And we would sit there and read step 11. We would meditate, and then we would write down what we got. And I said, I wish this would work. For 2 years I did that, and I wish this would work. And some of the stuff I got worked, but I didn't want to point that out. But I kept going through it. Today, when I get up in the morning, step 11 is the first thing that happens in my life. It's one of the most important parts of my day. And I get stuff out of step 11, and it's never what I want. It's always what I ought to be. It's always about what I should do or what my attitude is. What behavior, what attitude. What behavior, what attitude. I was trying to seek some guidance on how I should share today. He said, don't pull your notes out and don't go through your little ritual. Stand up there and try to be real. So I'm trying to be real today. And being real is uncomfortable, but I think it's what I'm trying to do. Whether I do it well or not doesn't seem to be the criteria my higher power is looking for. It's whether I'm willing to commit to that step. So today's step 11 is very, very important to me. Prayer was something that on Sunday nights was difficult. We would pray, and I'd say the words. I'd mouth them with you. One day we were standing in a circle, and they at the end of every meeting, they link hands, and they say the Lord's Prayer. I'd link hands, and I'd just go. And a woman next to me one day said, Lou, would you take us out with the Lord's Prayer? I don't pray. That's okay. And then she started off the Lord's Prayer. And for the first time, I realized someone was actually trying to let me be part of. what I had never felt when I was in that church, what I could never find when I was doing these other things, was being offered to me on a silver platter. And I went to her after that meeting. I said, if you ever ask me to say the Lord's Prayer again, I will say it gladly. I appreciate that you gave me a chance when I never gave myself a chance. And to this day, nothing in me has changed in that. I'm as happy as I can be with that decision, and I do feel part of. And that was a brand new experience for a guy who was almost 60 years old. That's kind of late to learn this stuff, but I finally got it. I guess the only thing I would want to add to this, as I kind of wrap up, is when I think about where I am today, I would like to live my life under the influence of a higher power. And I would like to have a sense of direction from a higher power. And I don't need to know where that's going to take me. I don't need to know what the outcome is. And I don't have to negotiate the terms. I'm at yes. This has become the single most extraordinary thing in my life. I get this sense that certain thoughts that come to me when I am open up might be influenced. And they're my best guess. That's what they are. They're guesses. But they seem right, and I try them. And if they don't work out, I'll keep guessing, because I can remember where I used to have no influence whatsoever, and I could find no thought that I could count on. And today, I'm unreasonably happy. I'm the luckiest guy I know. Now, I know that's a terrible thing to say in one of these meetings, because you say that in a bunch of alcoholics, and you have competition. And after you say that, I mean, they line up to say, let me tell you a story, and then you talk about who's the luckiest person in this room. And I got to admit, I can't really compete with you. But I'm as lucky as I have ever been, and I'll take it, and I'll be happy with it and grateful for it. So let me close with just a couple of things that I do have on notes that I would like to say. The other pages I don't read, these I still do. The great truth of Al-Anon for Lou is I can't care enough to change the insides of another person. They have to find their own way. If it has to do with alcohol, I'm out of it. And I just had to face it. I was never going to have the relationship I always wanted. I kept trying to change you into what I wanted you to be so I could be happy. Today, if I can have a relationship with you, that's good enough. It just has to be a clean relationship. I have a concept of what a higher power seems to be like, and there seems to be something bigger going on, perhaps a purpose. And I don't get to know what that purpose is all about, but I get to be part of it. That's good enough for Lou. I never really experienced recovery until I gave up all hope of ever having the childhood I always wanted. My mother, whom I had such anger toward, that I finally found freedom from, has changed in my mind. My mother was not the ogre I thought she was. My mother was, I need to make amends to my mother, and this is how I do it. My mother was raised by a man who was an alcoholic who was brutally, physically brutal to his kids and his family. She was beaten by him so badly she was bedridden. That's harsh. She couldn't wait to get out of that house. She got married when she was a teenager just to escape. They pulled her out of the school in the fifth grade and put her to work in a cotton mill. She married, of all things, an alcoholic. Can you imagine that? She got married and had three kids, and this guy was such a bad husband, and it was so tough that in the 40s, she got a divorce. It was not easy to have a divorce in the 40s. And then she ended up marrying my dad, and she raised me. She fed me, she clothed me, she changed my diapers. She helped me when I was sick. But she didn't know any better. She only knew what her family had taught her. And she passed some of that on to me. And I picked up on it unconsciously. And I used it as my unspoken rules in life. My mother was not an ogre. My mother was not a bad person. My mother simply didn't have Al-Anon in the 40s. What could it have been for her if she had been here today? I would wish Al-Anon on my mother today, because it would give her something she didn't have otherwise. And I am learning, I'm learning to take care of myself by a new set of rules. All those rules that I had for years that I followed that led crazy behavior, I follow Al-Anon pretty literally. Pretty literally. I detach, I let go, you sink. I mean, I detach. When I set boundaries, I set walls for a long time. I was a mason. Today, I don't have to be so rigid, but I follow the way, the learnings that I have. And I'm learning that my stories are just stories. They're what I thought they meant. The facts stay the same. The stories change. And they're different today. So the 12 steps, have made, how can I say this? I did not know how to change, so they said, don't worry about it. You don't have to. Just do the steps anyway. And if you change, you change. So I did the steps. And the 12 steps for me kept taking away noise in my life. And to me, the 12 steps are kind of like this. If you went outside this, the grounds here that we're on, and you went into that highway right at the intersection, and you stood in this intersection, and you stayed in that intersection out in the middle of that road 24 hours a day long enough, what's going to happen? You're going to get hit. I stayed in the 12 steps, doing them over and over mechanically, and one day I ran into God. When God showed up, always there, when I woke up, I was ready. And the 12 steps made it possible for me to do something I had never experienced before, and that's change. I came to Al-Anon because I needed to. I stay in Al-Anon because I want to. My name is Lou, and thank you for letting me join you today.